Hello and welcome to this episode of Military History Inside Out, presented by War Scholar. In today's episode, I speak with Brian Vandermark about his book on the Vietnam War. He actually starts off a little bit before the war with the Cuban Missile Crisis. And he talks a lot, or the book explores much about leadership and how people who are extremely intelligent and arguably well-intentioned can make very bad mistakes in a very high-stakes situation, as the Vietnam War was. So a lot of very interesting insights into the leadership, American leadership, during the Vietnam War. So thank you and enjoy. I'm speaking with Brian Vandermark, author of Road to Disaster. Thank you for speaking with me.
Thank you for having me on, Chris.
So first, can you tell me, from the beginning, how did you get into studying and writing the subject of this book?
Well, it's a long story, and I'll try to keep it brief. I'm 58 years old, so I'm old enough to remember the Vietnam War as a child. And I grew up during the 1960s and early 1970s. I was too young to be exposed to the draft, but I had friends in my neighborhood who had older brothers who were exposed to the draft. And I was politically conscious at a fairly young age, and I understood even then how powerfully emotional and divisive the Vietnam War was in American society. And as I grew up and went to college and graduate school, I wanted to address questions that the war had posed to me, which is how did we get involved, what were the consequences of that involvement. And eventually I wrote a doctoral dissertation on the Vietnam War, which led to my moving to Washington to help Clark Clifford as research assistant on his autobiography. Clifford had served as a legal counsel to Truman in the late 40s. He'd been there at the beginning of the Cold War, and he'd also been Secretary of Defense after McNamara in 1968, which was the bloodiest year of the Vietnam War. And then when that project was wrapping up, I accepted a teaching position at the Naval Academy in Annapolis. And shortly thereafter, I embarked on the biography of Robert McNamara, and I interviewed him in the course of the research, and after about a year and a half of research, another very detailed and critical biography of McNamara was published, and he asked me to read it and share my reactions and impressions with him. And I did, and I told him what I thought were evidence and what he wanted to hear, because by then I suspect he was a big man rather than a little one, who would accept and in fact appreciate honesty and criticism from people around him. And I told him, I said, it was a good effort, and that if he was willing to address his responsibility for decision-making in the Vietnam War based on the record and not wishful recollection, I would help him do that, because that book would be far more important than anything I could write about him. He agreed, and we proceeded, and he eventually published the book that people thought he would never write in 1995, after nearly 30 years of silence on the subject. And the reaction to that book was very powerful, very emotional. People on the left and the right just erupted in response to it. And I had failed to anticipate that. I thought that by being candid and accepting responsibility for mistakes, that it would have a healing effect, but instead it agitated people. And I reacted to that by essentially stopping writing on Vietnam. I didn't think there was anything I could say about him or the war that would be more impactful than what I had helped him do. And I had been disturbed by the emotional intensity of the reaction to his book. Mm-hmm. So he passed away in 2009, and a couple of years after that, I began to think to myself, it's about time to go back to that subject. 2 decades and more have passed since I helped him with his memoir. There's more time behind us. I have more perspective on this. I'm older. I have more experience. I think that my ability to approach that subject was just more mature and more more nuanced. And that's why I decided to write the book. I knew that I always probably would, given the fact that I'd worked closely with him and with Clifford. And I think that enough years had passed that the time had come for me to go back to that issue and wrestle with this fundamental question that was always in my mind, which is, how could good people make such terribly bad decisions? I knew them, who, and others who were Albert then called the best and the brightest. And it just, it was a paradox
So that segues into my next question, which is I'd like to talk about the book itself. I see it's laid out chronologically. How did you make, I guess that's perhaps the most straightforward way to do that, but did you perhaps think about doing it in any other way, or tell me your thinking about that?
Well, as a historian, the fundamental framework of most good history is chronological because it enables you to recreate the story as it happened and allows you to look at the chain of cause and effect in a sequential way and retelling the story in the way that it was lived. I think in addition to that, it's important to bring a thematic pattern to that work so that people understand that it's more than just a bunch of names and dates. It needs to be analytical, it needs to be interpretive, it needs to be explanatory. So if the narrative arc is chronological, you have to go beyond merely telling the story and, more importantly, explaining it to readers. And that's what I tried to do in this book.
So I see as one of the main themes I saw, or that I read in the description and in the prologue, the introduction, was organizational behavior. I believe you address that or look into that.
Yes, I think that in order to help me answer that riddle, which is how could people who I knew were well-intentioned and smart and loved this country participate in decisions that led to such grievous consequences. And it forced me to really think very deeply and get beyond the stereotype of hubris, arrogance, and ignorance, which is a part of the story, but it's not the deeper part of the story. It's an attractive way of understanding and explaining that story, but I don't think it really comes to terms with that other dimension of their character, which I knew because I got to work with them very closely, which is that they were smart, they did mean well, so they were intensely patriotic, and yet they made decisions that damaged this country tremendously, and that is a powerful paradox. It cannot simply be explained by hubris and ignorance. Mm-hmm. And that's why I looked at the issue of cognitive ability and how that affects decision-making. There's been a lot of social scientific research conducted in the last 20 to 30 years that addresses this issue of the cognitive constraints that undermine objective assessments of reality. That the harder the problems are, oftentimes the more binding these cognitive constraints become. And those constraints apply to very bright people as much as they do to you and me. And when you grasp that point, it helps you understand how these kinds of decisions could be made. It helps explain that paradox.
So I would think that a lot of people might look at the decision-making in two other ways, which have probably been examined a lot, which is, one, they might not have had all the information they needed, and two, that they were perhaps acting for the sake of politics. So I'm curious if you could address that.
Well, I think the first is certainly true, and to a degree, the second is applicable in the sense that they were all aware of political pressures, and at least the president has to factor political pressures into the equation when it comes to making decisions. Because at a fundamental level, every decision that's made by a president, if it's going to endure, it has to have public support. Mm-hmm. And that is at some acid level a political dynamic. Mm-hmm. And I mean that not in a negative way, but in a factual way. And I think that when you study the story of Vietnam decision-making, again, it's a train wreck. You can see all the things that were done wrong, all the misjudgments that were made, all the assumptions that were questioned, and that does help you understand and explain these errors. But the reality is that the process of decision-making then and now is fundamentally the same, which is you have very busy people confronting a constellation of problems day in and day out, and they're trying to cope with how to react to them in an intelligent and responsible way. Almost always, they're doing so with incomplete information against a rapidly ticking clock. And I think it's in that kind of dynamic where what social scientists refer to as heuristics, which are simplifying rules of thumb that people will use to make sense of the world when they have to make decisions in that world, heuristics, those rules of thumb, applied in complex and stressful conditions, psychology, cognitive science, and behavioral economics that's shared with all of us in the last 20 to 30 years, and I understood how that would apply and help explain this strategy.
So I think adding on to what you said, I think a lot of people who haven't worked, say, in the White House or the Pentagon, maybe don't have a clear idea of how complex decision making can be in those two places. Do you think anyone who hasn't experienced that can be taught to understand the complexity? Because I think a lot of people think, well, you're the president, you say what you want and it's done, or you're the Secretary of Defense, you say it and it's done. So.
Well, that's a very penetrating question, Chris, and I would like to think the answer is yes. That if you read a book like my book, Road to Disaster, it helps you understand the dynamics that afflict decision-making at the highest level. It is not a low-stress, low-stakes environment. It's a high-stress, high-stakes environment where they're making decisions with immense consequences. Particularly in terms of how it affects the lives of other people. And they're almost always doing that, as I said, with incomplete information under the pressure of time. And that is not the best circumstance in which to make consequential decisions. I frankly don't know that there is any other reality. That's the way Washington works at the highest level. It's a sobering, a deeply sobering fact. And I think most of those who have served this country at the very highest level are the only ones who can really grasp that point. And you hear that expressed often this way, which is presidents, once they've left office, will often remark on the contrast between the power that they assumed they would have when they became president and the very limited power that they actually had wield while they were president. Lincoln's comment is a famous one during the Civil War. I'm paraphrasing him now. But essentially what he said was, I did not control events. Events controlled me. And that is a recurrent theme of decision-making at the highest level, particularly when you're dealing with issues of war and peace. And what is so sobering about that is the consequences of bad judgments. But you mean well, and yet because you don't have all the information that you should, because you don't question your assumptions, because you're stuck in a mode of short-term rather than long-term thinking, you can make decisions that were well-intentioned but can have grievously damaging consequences. Mm-hmm. And I, frankly, I teach at the Naval Academy, and I tell the midshipmen over and over again, in all honesty, I don't see why anyone would seek to have a job like that with those responsibilities, because it's so demanding, and the parameters in which they operate are so harsh. I would run from it rather than try to seek it. Mm-hmm. Of course, someone needs to do it. Mm-hmm. But I think the jobs themselves, being Secretary of Defense, being Secretary of State, being President of the United States, frankly, are a hell of a lot harder than people could ever imagine until they actually have them.
So, considering what you said about the complexity and, you know, the time pressures, does McNamara's emphasis on sort of the operations research idea, I don't know if they called it that then, but was that a way of maybe simplifying is perhaps the wrong word, but simplifying or streamlining the process of war making to make it more manageable for the decision maker?
Well, McNamara had been trained in quantitative analysis at the Harvard Business School in the 30s. He practiced that as an Army Air Corps officer in World War II. He used that to maximize the efficiency of bombing operations against the cities of both Germany and Japan. And I think he had come to rely on quantitative analysis as a way of ordering information and making sense of it and measuring success or the lack thereof in terms of specific policies. And it was an approach to problem solving that he was good at, that he was familiar with, and that he therefore applied because it was something that was familiar to him. The problem with that was, well, there are many problems. He didn't know it at the time, and we didn't know it at the time, but a lot of the data that he was being fed by the South Vietnamese, particularly during Kennedy's presidency, before the assassination of Diem, was made up. And if the if it's garbage in, I guarantee you it's going to be garbage out.
Mm-hmm.
And you can ask yourself, well, why was he more rigorous in questioning the information that was being passed along to the Defense Department? I think part of the answer is that they wanted to believe what they were being given because it seemed to confirm progress. Their cultural ignorance of the Vietnamese was substantial. And whenever someone tells you something you want to hear, the inclination is not to question it.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, the other problem with Vietnam, particularly war in general, is that in some respects you can measure war quantitatively, but there are a lot of dimensions of war that have nothing whatsoever to do with numbers.
Mm-hmm.
For example, the fighting spirit of your adversary, you can't quantify that. The willingness of an adversary to absorb punishment on an unimaginable scale, that cannot be quantified. Their political passion and commitment cannot be quantified. The violence of war and the human suffering that comes with it is unquantifiable and yet crucially important. And I think that McNamara over time had to come to terms with that non-quantifiable dimension of war, and I think it shook him deeply.
Mm-hmm.
Because it essentially taught him that war is not always susceptible to reason.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, most people who have actually experienced war know that intuitively.
Mm-hmm.
I think the famous comment is the only thing you control in war is the first shot. After that, it's the iron law of unanticipated and unexpected consequences that rule. And that's a sobering thing for people who like to think that reason is the way to understand every element of the war, and it's not, unfortunately.
Mm-hmm. So going back to how the book is laid out, so it is chronological, and I noticed some chapters cover maybe a year, some are almost, or 2 years, you know, how did you break out the chapters? You know, what important thing made a particular date range? You know, why would you study a particular date range?
Well, what I was trying to do is identify important turning points in that 8-year period of the Kennedy and Johnson administrations. And then once I identified these segments that were enclosed within the bookends of turning points, I needed to understand and explain to readers what the key themes were that characterized the environment, the atmosphere, and the decision-making during those periods of time. And that's why each chapter is titled in the way that it is. For example, Chapter 3, which is the first chapter that turns directly to Vietnam, covers the background of the story and decision-making by the Kennedy administration through the coup that toppled and killed Diem and was shortly thereafter followed by Kennedy's own assassination. And one of the predominant dynamics during that period of the Kennedy administration's decision-making on Vietnam, particularly in the summer and fall of 1963 leading up to the coup against Diem, was that they did not think through the consequences of removing Diem. They focused on his shortcomings and tried to pressure him to mend his ways. And when they sensed that he would not or could not, then they implicitly gave the green light to the generals to get rid of him. But they didn't think through what the consequences would be. And there were warnings that were made by some advisors, but Kennedy never really pondered that side of the question, because he was so preoccupied with fixing the immediate problem that he didn't pay attention to the long-term consequences of a short-term fix. And I think that's a very human tendency. And of course, the great irony is Kennedy had an intuitive opposition to committing American military forces to that war, because he had experienced war. He understood the political dynamics of Vietnam as well as any politician of his information. But the unintended consequence of getting rid of Diem was to create pressure on the United States to intervene militarily because the political situation there fell through the floor after Diem was assassinated. So the painful irony is that one unintended consequence, one unanticipated consequence of getting rid of Diem was to generate pressure for exactly what Kennedy had sought to avoid, which was the commitment of American forces. He's dead 3 weeks after Diem's own death, and Johnson has to cope with the consequences of this vacuum that's created politically in South Vietnam by the removal of Diem.
Mm-hmm.
So that's how I would approach the book in terms of structure and framework.
So considering what you just said, what if someone were to suggest, well, you know, then the kind of leaders we need are leaders who don't think they know it all and surround themselves with advisors who give them alternative outcomes that might result and advisors who will make them think about future consequences.
Yes. Well, I agree with you, Chris. I think that in an ideal world, that would be highly desirable. Mm-hmm. The sobering reality is, and the world as it is, particularly the political culture of Washington, it's full of smart, ambitious people who think that they know it all, or don't need experts, or don't need to second-guess their assumptions. And I'm being a little bit hyperbolic, but I think you take my point. It's the highest levels of decision-making in that world of Washington tends to be inhabited by people who do not suffer from a lack of self-confidence. And I think in a fundamental sense, it's a willingness to be self-aware and to self-reflect, to step outside yourself and to ask yourself, what do I really know? What do I really understand? What do I really control? That's the surest way of mitigating the dangers of these cognitive constraints. The only problem is, that atmosphere doesn't encourage that kind of self-awareness and self-reflection. Mm-hmm. The pressure of decision-making doesn't either.
Mm-hmm. It was interesting to note that you start with the Cuban Missile Crisis, or at least that's one of the early events that you discuss. And being a book on Vietnam, I didn't expect that, and it was pleasant to see. So
yes.
I'm just curious if you... Yeah, go ahead, touch on that.
That's an excellent question, Chris. And several people have asked me about that. And the reason is a very deliberate one, which is I don't think you can really understand the atmosphere of decision-making in the Kennedy and Johnson administrations, and in particular the relationship between the civilian leadership and the military leadership during the Vietnam War, without understanding the preconditions or the atmosphere that was created early on during the Bay of Pigs and the Cuban Missile Crisis. For example, during the Bay of Pigs, Kennedy asked the Joint Chiefs to review the CIA's plan. They reviewed it, and they told him that it had a, quote, fair chance, unquote, of working. Now, Kennedy, being inexperienced wishful in his thinking, elected at that. What they didn't tell him, though, was their definition of fair chance was 30%. And I think that what Kennedy learned was that oftentimes what you need to worry about is what they don't tell you rather than what they do.
Mm-hmm.
And there was an element of what I would call skirting the line of insubordination on the part of the senior military leadership during the Bay of Pigs. Kennedy had made it clear, both to the Cuban Exile Brigade privately and publicly to the American people, that he would not use American military forces in Cuba. And when push came to shove and the invasion was failing, the military came back at him really hard, in essence pressuring him to use the U.S. military to try to save the situation. He told them again and again the answer is no, and they wouldn't take no for an answer. And I think that Kennedy, he lost faith in the judgment of the senior military as a result of those kinds of things. And that was repeated even more intensively during the missile crisis. For example, during the missile crisis, the Air Force Chief of Staff, Curtis LeMay, and the Chief of Naval Operations, George Anderson, both aggressively lobbied Kennedy to attack Cuba militarily during the missile crisis, saying that war with the communists was inevitable, it's better to have it out now. And Kennedy was appalled at that advice. He was trying to show American resolve without triggering a war with the Soviet Union that could lead to a thermonuclear exchange. And I think further erode his confidence in the judgment of the senior military leadership. And the point I'm trying to make to you is that's the background against which decision-making on the Vietnam War is going to be made. And by that I mean that Kennedy and later Johnson and McNamara and a lot of other senior civilians really question the wisdom and judgment of senior military leaders, that they made them therefore very reluctant to accept their advice at face value, and it made them reluctant to share with the senior military what their own concerns were about the way American warfighting was being prosecuted in Vietnam. And the reverse is also true. I think that for a lot of senior military officers, they had nothing but disdain and disgust for what they considered to be the spinelessness of the political leadership, and it made them unwilling to share their fears and apprehensions with civilian leadership. And the takeaway point is, during the war, the civilian leadership and the military leadership were not really being brotherly and totally candid with each other about what their concerns were. And that is not a recipe for good decision-making during a war.
Right. So let me ask about the resources you used for your research. You already discussed some of them. Can you expand on what you used to come to your conclusions?
Yes. The Kennedy and Johnson Presidential Libraries over the last 20 years have done a remarkably admirable job of making available to the American people the vast majority of records relating to decision-making on Vietnam. And in the last 10 years in particular, some of the richest material, which were recordings conducted by Kennedy and Johnson, have now been made available in totality. And they're important because, for example, when the Pentagon Papers were compiled, the people who compiled those papers had zero access to those presidential recordings. And frankly, what the Pentagon Papers often reflect are a lot of memorandums being shared at the second and third level by people. So that may influence the process, but that's not the level of decision-making that's decisive. Mm-hmm. And it's the availability of those recordings in the last 10 years that have really, I think, closed the circle in terms of understanding the dynamics of decision-making. In Kennedy's case, he recorded meetings, a lot of them, almost all of them, on the critical Vietnam decisions of the summer and fall of 1963. And it's utterly fascinating to listen to that exchange of opinions and viewpoints. A lot of those recordings have not been transcribed or published as transcriptions. Therefore, what you have to do is you have to listen to the tapes. And luckily, having met and known many of these gentlemen, it was easier for me to understand who was speaking. And it really gives you a sense of immediacy and texture, which is invaluable. In Johnson's case, he tended to record phone conversations, but he'd made a lot of decisions over the phone. And it helped you really understand the way his mind is working, what pressures he's dealing with, and why he's making the decisions that he is. So utilizing that material, which is very rich, was an important part of this book. You know, most historians have not really been able to incorporate that into their scholarship because those presidential recordings have only been completely released in the last several years. In addition to that, helping Clifford and McNamara with their memoirs, I conducted extensive interviews with both of them. Those interviews were taped, transcripts were prepared, and they run to many, many hundreds of pages, far more than 1,000 pages. And I've held on to those transcripts and reviewed them over the years and reflected on them. And thanks to the generosity of Clifford's family and McNamara's family, I was allowed unfettered access to them and use of them and quoting them in the book. And I do think that's another important dimension of this book, which is it adds to the record, it adds to the scholarly universe of facts, and I think that's very useful.
Were you, and I know the people involved would be very old now, but were you able to interview any other people for this research?
Yes. Well, I had, during the process of my PhD dissertation research back as far back as the mid to late 1980s, I conducted personal interviews with several of what Jim Howser referred to as the best and the brightest, and was able to utilize those interviews, but almost all of those all of us do, but it is an invaluable extra dimension to writing history when you can actually question, interrogate, cross-examine people who lived these decisions.
Now, after you're given an introduction and they agree to speak with you, what techniques do you use to sort of make them feel more comfortable and draw out the best information possible as you're speaking with them?
I think it's a combination of two things, Chris. One is they understood that I was a literary scholar who was really seeking answers to questions rather than grinding an axe or pushing an agenda. Vietnam was a very controversial subject even today, and I think they were sensitive about that, and it made them oftentimes reluctant to be interviewed at length by people because they did not want to be subjected to an harangue or a speech. Mm-hmm. And they knew that I was a serious scholar, and what I did in addition to that was I simply asked them open-ended questions and then shut my mouth. Mm-hmm. The thing about interviews is that you're going to get a lot more information at someone when you pose an open-ended question to them and then shut up. Because if you allow them to speak, they'll take the directions which you might not have anticipated and provide you insights and information that you might never have thought of asking. And people ultimately, I think, are willing to share more with you if they don't feel like they're being confronted or subjected to an inquisition, but letting them have their say. And it can be very revealing when you let someone speak at length.
So considering their high level, do you go in thinking, okay, there'll be one interview and that's it? Or do you, at the end, do you ask, hey, can we speak again sometime? You know, how do you manage that progress?
Well, I think it's true for a lot of human relationships. It's the question of building trust. Mm-hmm. When I first started interviewing McNamara, when I embarked on a biography, he was very guarded about talking to me. He made it abundantly clear that he would discuss everything but Vietnam with me. And of course I was frustrated and disappointed, but I accepted that and I said, I'm not going to, he's leaving the door open cracked by continuing to talk to me. I think over time, as he began to understand that I was posing tough questions to him, but I was not doing it in a highly confrontational or judgmental way, he became more comfortable, relaxed, and willing to speak very candidly with me. And I eventually realized, as I said before, he's a breed of man who is big and not small. He's not petty or wasn't petty in the sense that he respected people who told him the truth even if it's painful or would pose questions that might be critical. It takes a special kind of person to agree to that kind of advance. And I'm not going to name names, but Washington today is led by many political figures of both parties who I think are not big enough to absorb honest criticism and questioning from people. And it's a limitation. It's not a strength, it's a limitation.
Were there documents you wanted to access that were perhaps classified or not available yet that you needed to put FOIA requests in or make a special request to get access to?
Yes, but I think that was true more in the past than today because so many years have passed now since the Vietnam War that the process of declassification has been very systematic and very thorough. There's very little left now. Neither the Kennedy or Johnson Presidential Libraries that are still closed to researchers. The things that remain tend to be highly specific documents, memoranda, often, for example, it had to do with intelligence sources and methods. Mm-hmm. And they're not going to affect the story in any significant way, but the CIA keeps that information secret for reasons that I accept. Mm-hmm. The other point I would make, and this is an important point, which is American political culture is open, and the failure of the United States in Vietnam is an open book. And one of the things I respect and admire the most about our system of government is that we, the people, have a commitment to open access to records of decision-making, even of dramatically failed enterprises like American decision-making on the Vietnam War. And I think that said something very good about us and our system.
Mm-hmm.
I would note here that one of the major frustrations and limitations to scholarship is the continued reluctance of the Vietnamese to make their records of decision-making during the war open to anywhere near the degree that the United States government has.
Mm-hmm. What part of the research, and I know it's covered many decades, in fact, what part of it has been the most enjoyable or was the most enjoyable?
I think the sense of discovery. And I have to note here, too, that when you do research on Vietnam, it is a profoundly saddening and depressing endeavor. It's one of the reasons, frankly, why I didn't write on that subject for more than 20 years after McNamara published his book. In part, it's just an extraordinarily depressing subject. And if you're really going to reflect on it deeply, it saddens you. And I, as a historian and scholar, you have to deal with that. That's part of the territory. But it's not a happy story. It's not, therefore, a subject that motivates you to search out a sense of wonder or exhilaration. You have to go to a pretty dark place in order to do your research on that subject.
What did you find that was most surprising in this research?
I think, on a personal level, getting to know several of those who are referred to as the best and the brightest, getting to know them well enough and intimately enough to recognize that at the end of the day, they're also human beings like all of us. Just because they had a lot of responsibility, wielded power, and were very smart, did not make them immune from all the frailties and vulnerabilities that you and I deal with in terms of understanding the world and making decisions. They were just as susceptible to misperception, failing to question assumptions, wishful thinking, short-term thinking, denial, the tendency to double down when you're facing a difficult situation. They're just people. And I think that really internalizing that insight is important because it helps you understand the mistakes. It doesn't excuse them, but it helps you understand them because you realize that a lot of their processing mistakes are our processing mistakes.
Mm-hmm.
And the lesson that we learn from that is incredibly important and powerful. For example, when I teach at the Naval Academy on this subject, one of the things I drive home to my students is it's not the story of bad people making bad decisions. It's the much more sobering story of good people making bad decisions.
Mm-hmm.
The road to disaster is indeed paved with good intentions. And the reason I drive that point home to them is, and you can see where I'm going with this, those midshipmen are, in a sense, the best and brightest of their generation.
Mm-hmm.
They, too, are very smart. They, too, are very patriotic. They, too, are very well-intentioned. And they, too, are just as vulnerable to making grievous misjudgments as that generation was. And I want them to grasp that and to internalize that.
Mm-hmm.
It's not to protect them from making bad judgments in the future, but it's the best insurance policy that I can think of. It doesn't limit risk, but it mitigates it.
Mm-hmm. One thing you mentioned, in the post-9/11 world, you know, we're used to a lot of security around political figures. So there were three events that I saw in the introduction that really kind of shocked me. One was the self-immolation below McNamara's office, then the crowds attacking him. I forget which university.
And
then Harvard. And then the boat ramp or boat dock in Martha's Vineyard, I think, where the individual attacked McNamara, physically attacked him.
Yes.
It seems shocking that with all this strong emotion back then, that you could still have sort of relaxed security for lack of a better phrase.
It's a different world, Chris. I reflect on that myself. In some ways, it's extraordinary that people like Black Mirror became the iconic symbol of this war and all the emotions surrounding it were not attacked more often, because he had no security. Clifford had no security during the entire time that both of them served as Secretary of Defense. It's remarkable. I remember that I think Clifford told me the only security he had was his chauffeur carried a pistol. That was it. And this is during an era, remember, when civil protests in this country were so intense that they deployed the National Guard in Washington, D.C. and placed machine guns atop the steps of the Capitol out of fear of the potentiality of civil war. Now, that they ran greater personal risks as a result of that, but I also think one advantage was they were closer to ordinary people. Emotionally, psychologically, they weren't in a bubble to the degree that a lot of decision makers are today. And there's no way that that's healthy, because being in a bubble just reinforces that sense of being special, which is so toxic to being grounded in a sense of being self-aware and self-critical.
Yeah, it does seem like leadership over the decades has become more estranged from the voting public.
And I don't think in the long run that's healthy. I mean, there are risks inherent in being closer to people, but there are huge advantages as well. Because you understand, you can read the pulse of the American people better when you're moving among them rather than when you're in a bubble.
Was there a particular issue that was very difficult to come to a conclusion on, or maybe you feel you haven't really come to a conclusion that you're happy with?
That's a really hard question to answer, Chris.
I know there's a lot to choose from.
Yeah, there is. I guess for me, my greatest frustration is that I wasn't able to sit down and have lengthy conversations with all of the principal decision makers. I was lucky enough to have exposure to a lot of them. But for example, Robert McNamara was probably closer to John F. Kennedy than anyone else in that administration, with the exception of his brother. So in a sense, I got as close to understanding the mind of John F. Kennedy as I could by getting to know Robert McNamara well. But that's no substitute for actually having met Kennedy or interviewed him. Of course, I was 3 years old when he was assassinated, so that's a possibility. Clark Clifford was probably the closest to Johnson as anyone outside of his family. And in that sense, I was able to get close to his mind in the way it worked through Clifford. But also, I was 13 years old when Lyndon Johnson passed away. It would have been immensely helpful to be able to pick their brains. But of course, you know, I can't get into a time machine to do that.
Was there, and you mentioned how difficult and sad, you know, sort of depressing researching this subject is, but was there anything that was particularly emotionally moving for you, and that could be either negatively or even something positive that you discovered?
Oh, I think it's both. The pain and suffering caused by the war. I've seen that on the faces of many, many people, on the faces of Vietnam veterans. On the faces of Vietnamese refugees, on the face of Robert McNamara. Everyone involved in that war suffered in one way or another. And when you see that, when you witness that, it's a very sobering thing. And it just drives home the human consequences of war. And it just, as I point out in the prologue, you know, I teach at the Naval Academy, but to me, war is a pretty damn stupid way of solving differences between creatures who have the capacity to reason. Just the damage that can be done on a human level in war is just incalculable.
Oh, yeah.
And it's enduring. People will never get over that suffering. I used to not understand that, and now I do. The older I've gotten, the more I realized that if you were wounded psychologically, physically, or emotionally by the Vietnam War, you're going to be wounded for the rest of your life. And asking someone to get over that or put that behind them is asking more than a human being can do.
Yeah. Yeah. It's, yeah. What do you hope, then, the book will do?
I hope it will help people understand how and why the decisions were made, that they were made by human beings, not by monsters or by automatons, because I think it enables you and me and others to see in those decision makers. And it's great when you can place yourself in their shoes and say to yourself, oh my God, there but for the grace of God go I. That's a powerful thing. And I want today's decision makers to read that book. I want tomorrow's decision makers to read that book. I want people who wield power today and will wield power in the future to internalize their example. Because the bottom line truth is the best and the brightest were in fact the best and the brightest that have ever served the American people. And they made serious errors of judgment. And if the best and the brightest can do that, all of us can do that. And I definitely hope that decision makers today and in the future will read the book, because it is a major reality check.
So what's your next writing project?
I don't know, Chris. I'm sort of in a recovery mode right now. It's very taxing for me emotionally, psychologically, to deal with this subject. And I just need to put it aside, reflect, and then when the moment is right, get back up in the saddle and start doing research and writing again.
Wow, okay. So where can people find the book and maybe other writings that you've done or your thoughts, anything on social media?
I don't do very much social media, unfortunately, but the book, thankfully, is available widely in bookstores throughout the country, and it's available online to purchase at sites such as Amazon, Barnes & Noble. I think even Walmart and Target are carrying the book. And that's a wonderful thing, because it's not geared to an elite audience. It's geared to everyone, because I think that everyone can relate at a fundamental level to the humanity of that story. And that is a powerful and a good thing.
So I imagine a book like this still would, as McNamara's autobiography did, 20-some years ago, you're going to have strong opinions. Do you think you'll engage much with people, even if they have, emotionally based arguments, or are you going to just try to let the book speak for itself and just sit back?
I think mostly the latter, but I also respect people's opinions and their differences with each other and with me. It's okay. Every coin has two sides to it. I tell that to my students. Having a conversation in which reasonable people can disagree is perfectly acceptable to me, and I think that's really useful discourse in a democracy. And I think the willingness to listen is of crucial importance. My father once told me, he said, Brian, you learn a lot more by listening than talking. It's a truism, but there's a lot of wisdom to that. And I like listening to people and their opinions. I think you can learn from that.
Definitely. So that's all the questions I have. Do you have any final thoughts or words?
No, I'm just thankful and impressed with the quality of the questions that you put to me. They were good ones, and I hope I answer them in ways that are illuminating for your listeners.
Oh, I think so. Yeah, definitely. And thank you for that. Thank you for speaking with me.
You're welcome, Chris. Thank you.
Thank you for listening. One of the best ways to provide feedback on this podcast is to rate it on iTunes. Please let me know if you liked it, or give me a poor rating if you didn't like this podcast, and I can use that feedback to hopefully get better. Otherwise, please follow me on Instagram at Chris Alvarez War Scholar, on YouTube under War Scholar 1945, on Twitter at War Scholar, on Facebook under War Scholar, and you can find more information on my website, warscholar.org. Please remember, my name, Chris, does not have an H, so it's CRISALVAREZ. Thank you, and I hope you continue to enjoy this podcast.